pilots and get tangled with an astromech droid banging a chunk of skin from my left shin. Shouting in pain, I hop sideways on one leg straight into Jack Porkins. I sink into the side of the man, and he throws an arm around my head to try to ruffle my mustache with his ham-sized fingers.
Watch where you're going, laser brain!
Porkins chuckles like a hut, and I manage to wrench myself free of his squidgy embrace. Most of the Alliance veteran pilots, loose a term as that is, were accommodating to new recruits, especially given the nascency of their fighter squadrons. But Porkins, a cocky pilot from Bastine, seems to think it's his duty to institute ritual hazing, even on the brink of battle.
Hope you're better off your feet than on them,
he says with a grin. That sounds like an invitation. I snort a laugh. Do you want to try that again, Porkins? He grins and pushes me to the side.
Oh, I'm far out of your league, nerf herder.
It's not till the hangar that I catch up with my old friend, as he runs his hand along the fuselage of a T-65, with the same wistful expression he wore when we parted at Tashi Station just a few short weeks ago. He's dressed in a flight suit now. Hey, Luke! I shout. He wheels around, bright farm boy grin already on his face. Biggs? I laugh. I don't believe it. I throw an arm over his shoulder, questions tumbling out. How are you? How'd you get here? You coming up with us? He doesn't miss a beat. I'll be right up there with you. And have I got stories to tell you? Him and me both. How the hell did he end up in this? There's no time to ask. And even less time to tell him how happy I am he's here.
Skywalker.
Garvin Drace, Red Squadron leader, approaches from behind and nods to the rusted T-65.
You sure you can handle this ship?
I see the panic in Luke's eyes, and I cut in before he can answer. Sir, Luke is the best bush pilot in the Outer Rim territories. Garvin grins, knowing I don't give compliments lightly.
You'll do all right.
Luke smiles.
Thank you, sir. I'll try.
Garvin heads to his ship as Luke and I head down the line to our own. Gotta get aboard, I say, wishing we had more time. We'll hear all your stories when we get back, all right? He grins at me.
Hey, Biggs, I told you I'd make it someday.
He did. And I never doubted him once. Warm pride swells up in me like a twin desert sunrise. And I think how fitting it is that we are here, two sons of Tatooine. It'll be like old times, Luke. They'll never stop us. I leave Luke behind and find Wedge sitting on the boarding ladder to his cockpit. Biggs, he says with a distant smile. Who's the kid? Friend from home, I say. Always said he'd join the rebellion. Shame we don't have more Corellians, he grins. We'd have the Imperials running for Coruscant in a blink.
We got them right where we want them, I say. Good luck out there, Wedge.
And to you, Biggs.
We shake hands. I board my X-Wing and begin the pre-flight checklist with my astromech. As nearby technicians sheathe their hydro-spanners and shimmy off the aluminum engineer ladders, I feel happy. Knowing that all my boyhood competition and camaraderie with Luke has led us here, prepared us for this moment. We leave Base One behind, taxiing up away from the ancient temple, past the observation obelisks where sentries wave good luck, up from the sea of jungle toward the pregnant red hulk of Yavin. We breach orbit, and I feel space untether me from gravity. My heart rushes in my chest, while at the same time it seems as if my stomach has made a migration up into my throat. I'm thanking the stars I passed on that jet juice that Porkins was dishing out last night. Our squadron circles Yavin, and we see it for the first time. A pale gray orb, hanging in space like an untethered moon. Men built this.
I'd say it was impossible if I didn't see it with my own eyes. Our 30 tiny ships are nothing but gnats on a bantha. The joy I felt in the hangar is eroded by fear. So long as I was the only one exposed to this fight, the fear was something manageable. Something I could shove deep down into my stomach and forget like it was my private dark secret. But with Luke here, the fragile memory of home, friends, and family feels so very exposed. As if it could be broken at any moment. And the Leviathan is what will do the breaking. Garvin's voice comes over the comm unit.
All wings report in. Red 10, standing by. Red 7, standing by. Red 3, standing by.
I see. The confirmation rattles down the rest of the squadron until I hear Luke's voice. The fear fades. It might not be sand under our wings, but we've yet to face a run we can't manage together.
Lock S-foils into attack position,
Garvin says. The Death Star expands till it consumes my entire viewport. There's still no sign of enemy fighters. Can they really be so arrogant? My ship begins to shake. The control stick bucks against my hands like an unruly eel.
We're passing through a magnetic field. Hold tight. Switch your deflectors on double front.
Look at the size of that thing,
Wedge murmurs. I hear the fear in my friend's voice. The same fear that would steal the courage from me. It sweeps through the squadron as we coast toward the killing station. Inside are the men who destroyed Alderaan. A peaceful planet, if ever there was one. How many more will suffer if this evil is not taken down here and now?
Cut the chatter, Red 2,
Garvin says.
Accelerate to attack speed.
I shake myself in my cockpit and push forward on the throttle. We race closer. Closer till the station seems all there is. A hulking, impossible sphere of bone-hued metal and turbolaser towers and defense installations that jut up from the station's skin like ingrown hairs.
This is it, boys.
Red Leader, this is Gold Leader. We're heading for the target shaft now.
We're in position. I'm going to cut across the access and try to draw their fire.
Garvin's X-Wing banks hard diagonally down at the surface of the Death Star. I bank my ship to follow in a lazy corkscrew. A fury of green laser bolts lance up from the gray landscape, burning through the black of space. They pass harmlessly. The tower's too slow to track us as Luke, Wedge, and I skim close to the surface of the station.
Heavy fire, boss. 23 degrees,
someone says.
I see it,
Garvin replies.
Stay low.
Our three ships dip and weave through the communication and anti-aircraft towers.
This is Red 5. I'm going in,
Luke says, as he peels off from Wedge and me and dives toward a heavy turbo laser tower. His lasers burn across a trench line, digging furrows in the metal. But he's going in too hot. Luke, pull up, I shout. At the last moment, his ship pivots up from its collision course with the station and bounds away. Are you all right?
I got a little cooked, but I'm okay.
I sigh in relief as Luke forms up on Wedge and me. There's hardly time to reorient. Fire from dozens of turbolaser cannons laces the dogfight. Garvin, cool under pressure, identifies the source.
There's a lot of fire coming from the right side of that deflection tower.
I'm on it,
Luke says, hungry for another attack run. He always was the more eager of the two of us. Emperor was more than half certain he'd end up engine paste on the side of Beggar's Canyon rock shelf. To be honest, so was I. But I've never seen anyone with the run of luck Luke has. I form up on his flank to help with his attack run on the laser towers. I look on the scope to see who's nearby to offer support. I'm going in. Cover me, Porkins.
I'm right with you, Red 3.
The sound of his voice is a surprising comfort. Luke and I swoop low to the deck, weaving between towers, and concentrate our fire on the laser tower that was chewing up Gavin's wingmates.
flashes and glows as our cannons melt into its reflector shields, and then detonates as Luke and I soar past, just like bullseyeing womp rats. I whoop in exhilaration. Then Porkin's voice comes frantic over the comm.
"I've got a problem here,"
he says from above. I watch him on my scope. He's pinned in a field of overlapping fire and hit bad in the fuselage. "Eject," I say.
"No, I can hold it."
A second later, a laser enters the belly of his ship and detonates it from the inside. I look for a sign of an ejection, but there is none. Porkins is dead. I barely have time to register the loss when Base One hails us.
"Squad leaders, we've picked up a new group of signals. Enemy fighters coming your way."
"My scope's negative. I don't see anything,"
Luke says. "And neither do I." I crane my neck around to scan the space above me for the eyeballs.
"Pick up your visual scanning."
"Here they come."
"Watch it! You've got one on your tail!"
A cloud of fire ignites and dies as an X-Wing disintegrates to starboard.
"You've picked one up! Watch it!"
Luke shouts at me. I wheel my head around, juking and spiraling to confuse the TIE's targeting computer. I still haven't spotted him. I can't see him. I veer away from the Death Star to gain room to maneuver. The TIE's lasers lick past me. The hairs on my arms stand up. A weight grows in my gut. I jerk on the control stick. This guy is good. He's on me tight. I can't sink him.
"I'll be right there,"
Luke says. I even out, presenting the TIE pilot with a clean shot, making him an easier target for Luke. He drops in behind the TIE and sends a salvo of lasers into his rear fuselage for a clean kill. "All right. Good shooting, Luke."
"Thanks, Biggs. But we're not out of this yet."
I swerve my X-Wing back toward the Death Star and strafe several turbolaser towers that are peppering the Y-Wing Gold Squadron. Two detonate spectacularly. Above me, Luke has picked up a TIE on his tail. Debris shears off the top of the X-Wing just behind the pilot's canopy. I shouldn't have gone for the laser towers. I left him exposed.
"I can't shake him,"
he says. In a panic, I'm about to come at the TIE from underneath, when Wedge vapes the ship with a bold head-on attack run and soars straight through the debris. Damn, that man can fly. I form up on the two and check out the damage done to Luke's ship. "You got some damage there," I say. "How's the stick?"
"Still got maneuverability,"
Luke says.
"We gotta stay tight. No more running off."
"Copy that," I say, surprised and somewhat relieved that he's taking control of our flight wing. If Wedge hadn't been there, Luke would have been in some real trouble. That's on me. I got hungry for a kill, and I left my wingmate. Not again. We formed tight on each other.
"Red Leader, this is Gold Leader. We are starting our attack run."
"I copy, Gold Leader. Move into position."
Free from the harassment of the destroyed laser towers, the Y-Wings dive into the trench. Slower and older than our T-65s, they're more vulnerable to the enemy fighters and stronger against entrenched elements. Red Squadron provides cover for the Y-Wings as they continue down the trench. Luke, Wedge, and I tangle with a trio of TIE fighters. Lasers splash against my front deflectors. I juke upward and let off a stream of fire, clipping the solar panel of the TIE. It careens sideways into its wingmate, which Luke shreds with his lasers. Wedge spirals downward and kills the last fighter as it heads for the Y-Wings. But as we tangle with them, three marks slip underneath our dogfight and dive into the trench after the Y-Wings. "Three marks at 410, I say.
"We gotta keep them off the Y-Wings,"
Wedge says. We never get the chance. Another squadron of TIEs appears on our sensors, swarming us and cutting off our path. There's no time to think. The chatter dies, and Luke and I flow together wordlessly through the dogfight, as if attached together with tow cables, synced in perfect precision, one baiting the TIEs as the other hits them from the flank or rear. But even as we destroy the squadron, We hear the Y-Wings dying over the comms.
Gold 5 to Red Leader. I've lost Hutch. Came from behind.
Red boys, this is Red Leader. Rendezvous at Mark 6.1.
Ridge and I both copy. There's only 6 Red Squadron pilots left. The rest of the squadrons have been wiped out by the guns and the ties, and whoever killed Gold Squadron in the trench.
Luke, take Red 2 and 3. Hold up here and wait for my signal to start your run.
Garvin says, as his 2 wingmates dive into the trench, we pull him up at the end of it, where a hole has been carved in the turbo laser defenses, and watch the skies for ties. Sweat stings my eyes. Our window is shrinking. Garvin's comms crackle, almost inaudible as he carries down the trench into the teeth of the turbo lasers. One of his wingmates' comms gets through.
There's too much interference! Red 5, can you...
Coming in at 0.35.
Luke says.
I see them!
A flight of 3 ties diving down into the trench dozens of clicks away. One is larger than the others, swollen like a beetle with armor and advanced sensors. They disappear into the trench, and all we can do is watch, holding for our attack run. We're too far away to help. They're sitting ducks in there. I want to break free of our holding pattern and charge after them, but there's no time.
Just hold them off for a few.
I hear through the chatter.
Almost there.
A ball of fire flashes far ahead in the trench. One of the X-Wings disappears from my sensors. Then the second goes with it. Garvin's alone, without wingmates. But he's in range. They bought him enough time.
It's away!
He shouts and peels up out of the trench. His proton torpedoes fire at the exhaust port. Is it a hit?
Negative, negative. Didn't go in. It impacted on the surface.
Garvin says grimly. The armored tie that destroyed his wingmates has pursued him up out of the trench, spewing acid green laser fire at his engines.
Red 1, we're right above you. Turn to 0.05 and we'll cover for you.
Luke says.
Stay there.
Garvin orders.
I just lost my starboard engine.
Wedge and Luke are silent in their ships. I feel a chill go through me. Garvin knows he's going to die. If we go to help him, we'll lose our chance.
Get set up for your attack run,
he says bravely. The words are barely out of his mouth when he's clipped in the rear by a laser. He loses lateral controls and careens down into the surface of the Death Star, screaming. We're alone. Our squadron gone. Out of 30 ships, only 3 of us remain. And the Death Star is drawing around Yavin, mere seconds left before it can fire down at the moon and obliterate the rebellion, as it obliterated Alderaan. We are the last hope.
Biggs, Wedge, let's close it up.
Luke says, more authority in his voice than I've ever heard. Before today, we were friends, equals as boys, though the world always put me above him. I was older, wealthier, better with the girls at Tashi Station. When I saw him in the hangar, I thought I'd show him the ropes. But he doesn't need me to teach him any longer. He's different today from the boy I knew on Tatooine. He's a man now. And something, some strange calm fills his voice and soothes my nerves.
We're going in. We're going in full throttle. That ought to keep those fighters off our backs. Right with you, boss.
Wedge says. Luke, at that speed, will you be able to pull out in time? I ask. I can practically hear him smile.
It'll be just like Beggar's Canyon back home.
Grinning ear to ear, I follow him into a dive toward the trench, my ship vibrating as the engines are pushed to their limits. Luke's in the lead now, and good for it. He was always the better shot. We'll stay back just far enough to cover you, I say, remembering how easily Gold Squadron and Garvin's wingmates were picked apart. I have to buy him more time than they did. He has to have a chance at the shot, and a hell of a shot it'll have to be.
My scope sees the tower, but I can't see the exhaust port. You sure the computer can hit it?
Wedge asks. Lasers spray fire down the trench at us.
Watch yourself! Increase speed, full throttle!
Luke replies.
What about that tower?
Wedge presses nervously.
You worry about those fighters. I'll worry about the tower.
Luke snaps. We race through the trench like womp rats with their tails on fire. Lasers burn past us, their green lances filling our viewports as we juke maniacally within the narrow confines of the trench. It's a miracle we don't collide with one another or the walls. I spare a glance up through my canopy to look for the enemy ties and almost careen into the wall. I correct myself and chance a look back up. Wedge spots them before I do.
Fighters coming in point three!
He says. They're directly on our engines, matching our breakneck pace. Their lasers flash between our S-foils before connecting with the engines of Wedge's ship. His X-wing bucks sideways, almost colliding with mine. I bank hard on my stick and skim a hand's breadth from the walls, nearly shaving off my right S-foils. I jerk back toward the center of the trench, wary of Wedge's wobbling ship. He could take us both out with his internal stabilizer malfunctioning.
I'm hit! I can't stay with you!
He says.
Get clear, Wedge. You can't do any more good back there.
Luke replies.
Sorry.
Wedge pulls out, and I'm left alone. My sensors are scrambled from the interference of the trench. I crane my head around to see the ties behind me. They're accelerating, not just matching my velocity now, but outstripping it, reeling me in for the easy kill. Hurry, Luke! I rush. They're coming in much faster this time! We can't hold them! I could bug out, like Wedge, and they wouldn't follow. I could shunt the remaining power from my overworked reactor to my rear deflectors to keep myself alive, but without power for the engines, I'd fall behind. They'd leap past me and shoot Luke down. What do I do? I feel a sudden, inexplicable joy open up in me. A powerful feeling of purpose, of peace, urging me to make the choice I always would have made. To save my friend. I strip all power from my deflector shields and guns and put it into my engines, gunning them past the red line. My ship leaps forward, a shield for Luke. But there's more power in the advanced tie behind me than in my X-wing. It accelerates after me. I glance back and hear the warning of a target lock. The calm disintegrates. Wait, I hear myself saying. To whom, I don't know. Some man who cannot hear me? It wasn't supposed to end this way. I can't leave Luke yet. We have so much yet to do. First the Death Star, I thought when I saw him. Then the liberation of home. Coruscant. All the planets in the galaxy. Together we'd be unstoppable. But a cold feeling of dread enters me now, as I see the green lasers leap through space and collide with my engines. They shear through the hull of my ship and out the other side. A fire starts in my controls. Then another salvo eviscerates my ship. But beyond the terror, beyond the flaring light of my disintegrating hull, beyond the dark reaches of the Empire and the endless black of space where stars burn like little promises of hope, I feel the wind of Tatooine sweeping across the desert and hear the call of my mother for dinner. And I know beyond a shadow of a doubt that Luke will not miss. The fear is gone, and there is only peace.
Grounded by Greg Rucka. Neera Case sat on an empty proton torpedo crate in the former Masasi Temple on Yavin 4, in what the rebels used as their main fighter bay, with her boots dangling 8 centimeters from the floor. And she stared at nothing, and waited for the grief to come again. She'd been religious growing up, a gift from her parents, who had venerated the Force in the firmest tradition. Their home had been their ship, and they'd had no world, just the endless, repeating cargo runs, from the core worlds to the outer rim to the mid-rim and over and over. She'd been born on their ship. She'd lived the first half of her life on their ship. She'd imagined she would die on their ship. Instead, it was her parents who had died, and their ship had been impounded by the Empire. In the space of 7 minutes, Neera Case lost her home and her family. In the space of 7 minutes, the Empire had made her their enemy. She couldn't remember any prayers, but that was all right, because an insincere prayer seemed to her less than useless at the moment. She was a small woman, 3 years shy of 30, and the combination of a decidedly youthful face and small stature caused people, in particular new arrivals to Base One, to mistake her for much younger than she was, and by extension, someone of little import and no authority. Her general appearance did nothing to correct this assumption. The mechanic's jumpsuit she habitually wore could at best be described as stained, and only the greatest charity would have gone on to call it flattering to either her frame or her figure. When she was only 7, she had discovered, the hard way, that long hair in a narrow crawl space could lead to getting hung up on the machinery, pain, and disaster. She'd shaved her head ever since, but the last week had been utterly relentless, and Case had barely found time to bathe or eat, let alone groom or sleep. The result was now her scalp appeared as smudged and grimy as her clothes. Despite all appearances, however, there were those in the rebellion, and in particular in the High Command, who would argue that Neera Case was one of the most crucial people on Base One. Of those, at least 2 would have taken it further and argued that she was one of the most critical people in the entirety of the Alliance to restore the Republic. Mon Mothma and Bail Organa may provide the heart and soul of leadership, but Neera Case, they'd have argued, puts the body in motion. Case shifted on her crate, sore and tired, and continued to wait. Her tool belt, overloaded to the extent it now rode her hips rather than her waist, clattered softly in response. She tightened her grip on the data pad in her hand. She didn't look at it. She would have to soon enough. She would put that off for as long as she possibly could. The bay wasn't truly empty, it just felt that way. The same way a closet cleared of clothes feels empty no matter how many hangars have been left behind. There were service vehicles and cargo trolleys and load lifters parked all around the space. Crates of ordnance, most of them as empty as the one she now sat upon, stacked up high against the walls. Fuel lines crisscrossed the floor of the bay, running from haste pumps and fuel cells, curled around the many scattered repair and fabrication stations used to keep the fighters fit and flying. A couple of droids idled, duties completed, lost in electronic standby dreams. Aside from the droids, Neera Case was alone. The flight crews, all 67 sentients she coordinated and guided through every hour of the day, day in and day out, had left shortly after the last fighter lifted off. Most were now crammed into the pilot's briefing room, where they could watch the telemetry data come in live from the battle about to be joined. Those who hadn't gone to the briefing room were likely clustered in or around the command center itself, hoping to do the same. Anywhere they could see and hear the pilots flying into the mouth of Imperial evil. They'd launched every fighter they could for the battle. There'd hardly been a point in holding anything in reserve, after all. 30 fighters divided into 2 groups, red and gold. 22 INCOM T-65B X-Wings and 8 Conesayer BTL A-4 Y-Wings against the largest battle station the galaxy had ever seen. 30 fighters against a machine that could destroy a planet. 30 fighters against an empire that would do it again and again and again if they weren't stopped. There wasn't a single person on the base, not a single pilot up above who didn't know what had happened to Alderaan. There wasn't a single person on the base who didn't understand what was bearing down at this exact moment on Yavin 4, and what would befall countless other planets in its wake unless the rebellion ended this, here, today. It ended now, or it would never end. Only 7 spacecraft remained in the bay now. 5 X-Wings, 1 Y-Wing, and 1 U-Wing. 2 of the X-Wings had been cannibalized for parts following the Battle of Scarif, and the other 3, though flight-worthy, had no pilots to crew them. The lone Y-Wing needed another 36 hours of dedicated effort just to get its repulsor engines back online, let alone its ion thrusters. The U-Wing was another story entirely. It was ready to go, but had been left behind during the battle a week ago due to lack of available crew, and would have been utterly useless in the attack about to commence far, far overhead. Far, far overhead, but coming inexorably closer. As if in answer to the thought, the hangar's sound system crackled to life, speakers clicking on high above her where they'd been secured to the ancient stone ceiling. Someone in the command center, most likely the flight controller, was patching in the live audio from the fighters to the ground. There was a hiss that faded to silence, then a fresh ripple of static, and then Case heard Red Leader's voice.
All wings report in.
Red Leader, flying Red One. Pilot, Garvin Drace, 21,082 flight hours, quadruple ace, 24 confirmed kills, Case thought automatically. Serious, sincere, precise. One of the most level-headed pilots she had ever known. Professional, that was the word. She'd had a crush on him for the better part of a month after they'd first met, all because he'd taken the time to get down on his back beneath Red One, where Case had been trying to get the haptic feedback to properly compensate on the fighter's mag launchers. They'd spent 20 minutes under there, Drace handing her tools and talking specs, and when they'd finished, he had given her a nod and a smile and turned to go. As he went, he'd extended his left hand, stroked the side of the fighter's fuselage like he was petting a much-loved beast of burden. Case was certain Drace hadn't even realized he'd done it. Over the speakers, one after another and in no appreciable order, each of Red Squadron's pilots called in.
Lock S-foils in attack position,
Red Leader said. In the same way that her mind tied each pilot to his or her ship, Case immediately could picture the execution of the maneuver without any conscious thought. Each of Red Squadron's pilots on their sticks, each of them reaching out to flip the same switch in each of their cockpits. The current pulsing as the circuit closed, the charge redirected down the wiring that ran through the dorsal hull to the splitter, where the signal was redirected port and starboard, ordering the actuators to engage. The hydraulics coming to life in response, flooding fluid into the motivator channels, the strike foils opening as if each of the X-Wings were flexing its biceps. There'd been a problem with the hydraulics on Red 7's fighter following Scarif, Case remembered. Red 7, pilot, Alihek Ru, 3,804 flight hours, ace, 6 confirmed kills. Not a hot shot, but not a traditionalist by any means. The man could make any fighter you put him in twist, turn, and tumble. He flew hard, had flown hard at Scarif, and Red 7 always came back the worse for wear. Case had lost count of the hours she and her crews had put into recalibrating systems on the fighter, on making certain that when Rue needed it, the ship would answer as called. They were passing through the magnetic field. She heard Red 2, pilot Wedge Antilles, 1,598 flight hours, ace, 9 confirmed kills, break comm protocol, heard the awe in his voice, and Red One told him to clear the channel. Case understood that Garvin Drace wasn't so much admonishing Red Two as he was using the opportunity to refocus the pilots, all the pilots, on the task at hand. Case didn't know what she thought of Red Two. His time on the stick was misleading. He'd flown for the Empire, trained on ties, had flown before that doing what she didn't even know. He was one of the few pilots on Yavin who could claim to have logged flight time in an A-Wing. General Syndulla vouched for him. Everyone who'd flown with him said he was the real thing. Whenever he spoke to Case, he always called her ma'am, was always polite to the point of shyness with her crews. And he was almost a double ace already. Case could almost feel sympathy for any Imperial TIE fighter who found himself in Wedge Antilles' crosshairs. Sometimes it was the quiet ones you had to watch out for. The only pilot Case genuinely wasn't sure about was the new Red 5, Luke Skywalker, unknown flight hours. Prior to Scarif, Red 5 had been Pedron Gaul, 952 flight hours, 1 confirmed kill. Awkward and eager and still rated as a cadet. He'd died over Scarif, disintegrated while attacking the shield gate. Like so many others who had died over Scarif. And high above them at this moment, Case knew that so many more would die over Yavin 4. With an effort, she pushed herself off her perch, landed with another clattering of the tools at her waist. The battle was about to be joined. She needed to be in the command center for this part. The grief followed her, waiting for its moment. The pilots know the truth. They are the women and men who test their skill, their mental fortitude, their physical strength in machines that reward even a moment's inattention or complacency with cruel and oftentimes fatal retribution. They put their lives on the line every time they go up, whether in combat or outside it. The glory they wear as a result is bought dear and much deserved. To fly in combat is to tax the body in ways that even the most battle-hardened ground trooper will never understand. It is physically exhausting, the pilot responding to constant stress, acceleration, deceleration, the variance of artificial gravity and true gravity. The rank funk that rises from the cockpit after a battle is heavy with sweat and adrenaline and fear, all cooked in an atmosphere of recycled air and overheated electronics. It is mentally exhausting, demands constant situational awareness and multitasking. It requires a mind's eye picture of the battlefield in three dimensions, constantly in motion, a macro-level view that no computer will ever adequately replicate. It requires an obsessive, relentless attention to detail, a total understanding of not just the pilot's own vessel, how it is responding, what it is trying to tell him or her, but also of all those that surround it. Yet when viewed from afar, the pilots and their ships are seen not as a cohesive unit, but rather as a mass of individuals. They may hunt in a pack, but the belief is that every pilot flies alone. But the pilots know the truth. The pilots know this. They never fly alone. Every time they take to the skies or the stars, the pilots take their flight crews with them. Every flight they carry with them the men and women who made it possible, the men and women who poured heart and soul into not just caring for their ship, but into caring for the pilots themselves. On Yavin 4 at Base 1, each Rebel fighter was served by a crew of 5 or 6 personnel, depending on the needs of the ship and its pilot. Logistically, this meant that every flight crew worked triple, even quadruple duty. Thus, a single ground team of 5 was responsible for Gold 2, Dex Tyree, 3,237 flight hours, Ace, 5 confirmed kills, Red 9, Nazo Natan, 1,060 flight hours, 3 confirmed kills, and Red 12, Huck Nako, 5,879 flight hours, double Ace, 11 confirmed kills. These teams served both the fighters and, by extension, the pilots, in a relationship that was intensely personal and oftentimes intimate. Ship, pilot, and crew became one. When a ship was lost, when a pilot was lost, the crew remained. And they grieved. For Neera Case, it was worse. Every ship, every pilot, and every member of the ground crew was her responsibility. From the astromechs to the ordnance loaders to the mechanics and up to the pilots themselves, they all belonged to her. That was her job. Chief Neera Case. Fighter Boss. Base 1. Her flight crews. Her starfighters. Her pilots. She carried with her every pilot fallen in combat. And she carried their crews as well, bearing their grief atop her own. Their sorrow when their pilots failed to return. Their self-recrimination and self-doubt. All the hours lost wondering if there was something more that could have been done, or should have been done, or worst of all, something they failed to do. Another tweak of the deflector shields, an extra boost to engine efficiency, a higher cycle rate on the laser cannons. Something, anything that would have brought their pilots safely back home. Neera Case had lost 15 ships and 19 pilots and crew in the past week alone. It had begun with the mad scramble to put Blue Squadron onto target at Edu. A flight of 7 X-Wings and 2 Y-Wings quickly scrambled at General Draven's order for a hit-and-run. 2 never came back. Less than 36 hours later had been the Battle of Scarif. 2 of Blue Squadron never made it past the shield gate protecting the planet. Another 2 were shot down over the beaches, including Blue Leader, General Antok Merrick, 22,542 flight hours, quadruple Ace, 24 confirmed kills. 11 more fighters, mostly out of blue and red squadrons, had alternatively been shot down by Imperial emplacements, destroyed by TIEs, or taken by the pilot's worst enemy of all. Bad luck. 15 ships, 19 pilots and crew. In just 1 week. Nobody under Neera Case's command was untouched. Some of her crews had suffered multiple losses over the course of a single day. She had suffered them all. It was as still as a morgue in the command center. Case entered quietly, moved around the edge of the room to where she could keep an eye on the tracking board. Three of her crew chiefs had made it inside, pressed against the wall. Bennis, Oli, and Wuz. They gave her the slightest nod of acknowledgement. Nobody else noticed her. Everyone was concentrating, listening. General Dodonna and Princess Organa, along with one or two others and a protocol droid, were gathered around the map display in the center of the room. Case looked at her datapad. If the ships, the pilots, and their crews were the focus of her life, then the datapad was the nucleus. On it, she kept everything relating to her duties. Manifests for equipment and munitions, a detailed list of spare parts for every make and model of fighter base one could field, the names and assignments of every member of her crew, with notes on their specialties, their strengths, their weaknesses. Y-wing influx rephase not processing at full efficiency? Put Darton Bailey on it, he'd have it singing again in minutes. Stuck repeating blaster mount on a U-wing? Give Bennis a hydro spanner, and if that didn't work, let her whack at the mount with the blunt end until it behaved. She even had an inventory of flight suits and helmets, and an icon guide just in case one pilot's helmet was ever mixed up with another's. She also had the roster of pilots. Case switched her attention to the fighter tracking board, listening and watching. The initial attack on the station had begun, gold and red squadrons each making preliminary assaults to degrade the Death Star's defenses. Case tracked the small dots and squares, the X-wings and the Y-wings, moving in two dimensions along the etched glass. Gold 1, John Dutch Vander, 19,997 flight hours, quadruple ace, 22 confirmed kills. Broke his squadron, taking Gold 2, Dex Tyree, 5,062 flight hours, double ace, 13 confirmed kills. And Gold 5, Davish Pops Crail, 7,603 flight hours, ace, 7 confirmed kills, on approach for the Meridian Trench. The remaining 5 Y-wings in the element split, holding back, as Red Leader brought his group across the axis, trying to draw their fire. Then Gold 7, Gazdo Wilcop, 4,816 flight hours, 4 confirmed kills, vanished from the board without warning. Anti-ship battery fire, Case told herself. She checked her datapad and marked his name, and added a note. Flak. Red Squadron was engaging the surface batteries now, trying to clear the way for Gold 1's element. Red 3, Biggs Darklighter, 5,874 flight hours, triple ace, 16 confirmed kills, called his target. Red 6, Jek Tono Porkins, 10,499 flight hours, double ace, 14 confirmed kills, followed him in and...
I've got a problem here,
Red 6 said.
Eject,
Red 2 said.
I can hold it.
Case looked through the board to where Wuz had, even in the poor light at the edges of the room, gone pale. Red 6 was one of his ships, tended by his crew. Porkins had only recently, very recently, arrived at Base 1, brought in to take over for the grounded Wes Jansen. Unassigned, 9,869 flight hours, ace, 8 confirmed kills. Jansen had expressed concerns about the electricals on the fighter, in particular some of the glitching he'd been experiencing with his astromech's interface to the X-Wing's augmented sensor package. Wuz had assured Case he'd gone over the fighter millimeter by millimeter, that the ship was good to fly.
Pull up!
Red 2, almost shouting now.
No, I'm all right.
There was a flash of static as Red 6's comm channel flared out, almost in time, but not before everyone heard him start to scream. Wuz looked to Case, shattered. Case checked her pad, marked off Red 6, Porkins, and then added, mechanical? When she looked up again, Wuz had gone. Then the Empire launched their fighters. The battle over the Death Star lasted another 17 and a half minutes. Case ticked the names on her datapad without emotion. She made a note with each loss, and where she was uncertain of the cause, she added a question mark. She concentrated on her job, moving her attention from the pad in her hand to the tracking board and back, over and over again. Tie. Flak. Tie. 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 Flak. Flak. Tie. Tie. Flak. Tie. 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 Flak. Tie. 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 Tie.
Red Leader, we're right above you,
said Red Five.
Turn to Point Five, we'll cover for you.
Case looked up from her datapad.
Stay there,
Red Leader ordered.
I just lost my starboard engine. Get set up for your attack run.
Garvin Drace. She'd never had the nerve to tell him about her crush. To say anything. To do anything. He was always a professional. The whole command center heard his scream as he was shot down. Case made a note. Tie. There were four ships left. Only four. Gold 3, Yvonne Verlaine, 3,637 flight hours, 4 confirmed kills. Red 2, Red 3, and Red 5. Gold 3 had tried to get around behind the element that had claimed Gold Leader and Red Leader attack runs, but her Y-Wing didn't have the speed and it didn't have the maneuverability, and she was forced to do what she could from above, trying to stay alive amid the combined fire from the Death Star's turbo lasers and the TIE fighters still hunting above the trench. Then Red 2 took a hit, and Case moved her hand, ready to make her note, and she heard Red 5 ordering him off. The regret in Wedge Antilles' voice came through loud and clear, but he did as ordered. Case was mildly surprised that the TIEs let him go. Her eye tracked his travel on the board, watched as Red 2 maneuvered to assist Gold 3. The Death Star was in range of Yavin 4. Case watched the board. Red 3 vanished from the screen. She checked the line Red 3, Dark Lighter, and dutifully added the word TIE. Red 5 was somehow still flying. He'd taken a hit earlier dogfighting a TIE, and the repair made by his astromech had now broken free. She imagined him trying to control the X-Wing, wondering if he had ever, in fact, flown an X-Wing before, or even anything like it. Wondering if he could keep the fighter, now with a broken port stabilizer, steady enough to make his shot at the exhaust port, without at the same time turning himself into an easy target in the shooting gallery the Meridian Trench had become. His computer's off, someone said. He switched off his targeting computer. Luke, your targeting computer's off. What's wrong? Case tensed. Red 5 had been one of Bennis's ships, part of her crew. If this was another mechanical...
Nothing,
said Red 5.
I'm all right.
If the command center had been as still as a morgue when Case had entered it, it now had the silence of the same. Nobody moved, each of them processing what they had just heard. There was a fizz of static, an electronic wail.
I've lost R2!
That would be his astromech, then. Case found the line on her datapad that read, Red 5, Skywalker. There was truly no point in continuing now. It was clearly over. The Death Star had cleared Yavin, was at this very instant preparing to fire on Yavin 4. In a few more seconds, a minute perhaps, everyone and everything here would go the way of Alderaan. Pilots, ships, crews, data pads, all of them, everything would cease to exist. The Rebellion would cease to exist. But the Empire... The Empire would continue. A voice cut across the comm in the command center, broke the silence. The voice was yelling, but it wasn't in pain. It sounded to Case an awful lot like glee.
You're all clear, kid. Now let's blow this thing and go home,
the voice said. Her eyes went to the tracking board, to the call out for Red 5. She saw the notification flicker across the glass. Torpedoes away, it said. Nobody dared to breathe. Then, just as silently and without any fuss, on every monitor that had shown the graphic representing the Death Star, the graphic winked out. The call-out on the tracking board in front of Case was the last to go. The image of the Death Star, far too big to be shown on the glass, represented only by the simple words Battle Station at the center of the board. Then those two words vanished as well. The voice was saying something, but Case couldn't understand it. Nobody could understand it because suddenly everyone was in motion and everyone was making noise. Hugging one another, jumping up and down as they laughed, as they screamed in triumph, as they poured out their relief and their joy. Case saw the princess through the glass look skyward, mouthing something, then run for the exit. General Dodonna followed after her into a scrum of men and women rushing to clear the room, to get to the hangar, to welcome the pilots home. Bennis and Oli were waiting for her in the doorway. "I'll catch up," Case told them. They nodded and rushed out after all the others. Case was alone. She stood still for several seconds, data pad in her hand. Then, very carefully, she switched it off and lay it on the nearby console. She tried to take a step and succeeded, and tried to take another one and failed. And she collapsed with the sob already rising out of her and the tears already beginning to fall. The grief caught her.
Contingency Plan by Alexander Freed. In the very near future, no more than a day from now, there's going to be a battle above the fourth moon of Yavin. Scored and pitted X-Wings will launch from the moon's jungle, condensation boiling off their hulls as they emerge from the atmosphere under the light of a red gas giant. The squadron will race toward a space station armed with nightmarish weapons dreamed up by bitter old men. The X-Wing pilots, young and ambitious and good-hearted youths who have already seen their share of bloodshed, will seek to exploit a vulnerability in the station and ignite its reactor core. But their hurriedly assembled plan will fare poorly against the designs of the bitter old men. One by one, their starfighters will be destroyed. The space station will enter the moon's orbit from where it will emit an obliterating beam that disintegrates every storied stone of an ancient and haunting temple. Along with the temple's inhabitants. Along with the rest of the moon, besides. This is not the future Mon Mothma hopes for, but it isn't an unlikely one. "I could overrule you," she says, as she diligently transfers a stack of data pads from her desk to a metal case. She double-checks the files on each device before stowing it. She reviews rebel cell listings, coded contact frequencies, safe house locations, stolen Imperial documents. 20 years of work reduced to a courier package, she thinks. "Overrule me to what end? Even if things go well, you can't help us. We'll need to dismantle the whole base." Jan Dodonna raises his hands haplessly in the doorway to Mon's office. "If things don't go well..." He works his lips before the words finally form. "Mon, you won't just be leading the rebellion. You'll be all that's left." Mon doesn't flinch. She learned to suppress that instinct in the Senate. Back when there was a Senate. But she slams the case shut too hard. The snap of the latches echoes in the small chamber. "I want every droid in the complex ready to analyze those station schematics once the princess lands. If they're tracking her, if her signal was accurate, the Empire won't wait long to follow." Did she give that order already? She wonders. She hasn't slept in over 3 days, and facts and intentions are blurring together. She brushes past Jan, who follows her down stone steps toward the hangar and the jungle's tapering drizzle. Sion appears at Mon's side with a pair of duffels slung over her shoulders. "Fresh clothes and small arms," Sion explains, "along with a few mementos." Sion served Mon in the capital before Mon began moonlighting in treason. Since then, since Mon's flight from the Empire and public endorsement of the rebellion, she's barely left Mon's side. She probably added the evacuation to my daily calendar. "I spoke to the comm crew," Sion goes on. They move onto the tarmac and into a wet, tepid breeze. "We'll contact Base One every 90 minutes for updates." "The Empire may jam our transmissions or try to trace incoming signals," Jan adds. "If you can't make contact, don't keep trying forever." He hesitates as they approach a passenger shuttle covered in fading pastel graffiti. Mon doesn't recognize the alien alphabet. "Do what has to be done, Commander." He snaps a salute. Raindrops wriggle between his fingers. Mon can't recall ever seeing him salute her before. She reads it as a final farewell. "Give my thanks to the princess when she arrives," Mon says. "And my condolences," she wants to add, because she knew the princess's father so very well. But it's no use thinking about Bail right now. She would embrace Jan, but there are flight crews watching, and they need to see her strength. Instead, she climbs aboard the shuttle, clutching her metal case in both hands. Sion hauls herself in behind Mon, seals the hatch, and calls orders to the pilot. As the vessel rises from the tarmac, leaving the rebels of Yavin to fight for their lives against an impossible foe, Mon wonders whether Jan understands at all what has to be done. Like Mon, Jan is simultaneously practical and idealistic. He may well understand, and that thought breaks Mon's heart. In the future, or in a future, a not unlikely future, the obliteration of Yavin 4 will send the remnants of the rebellion into a panic. Mon will try to reestablish contact with the surviving rebel cells to implement some sort of coherent strategy. But she'll be left impotent amid the chaos. Her shuttle will jump from star system to star system, constantly fleeing pursuit. And she'll spend hours daily listening to static on her comm unit and watching her life's work fall apart. The scattered rebels will seek refuge among civilians, but will find no haven. The destruction of Alderaan, a peaceful world, a beloved world, home to billions, will have convinced the ordinary people of the Empire that they cannot afford to show complicity in rebel crimes. It's one thing to endanger oneself for a cause, after all. Another to endanger one's entire home planet. Stormtroopers will massacre the last remaining insurgents, hunting them relentlessly through deserts and treetops and hollowed-out asteroids. One day, a death squad will find Mon Mothma and Sion hiding in their shuttle in the radiation belt of a black hole. The shuttle's engines will be non-functional, its fuel spent. Without scanners, they won't notice the TIE fighters until too late. Within the decade, the rebellion Mon built will be erased from history and erased from consciousness. Just like the Jedi. There are 4, maybe 5 safe houses in range that we believe are secure and well supplied. Also, 2 habitable planets off the Imperial charts, if you're willing to go without infrastructure. The mobile squadrons haven't managed to regroup, so we shouldn't count on those. Sion goes on as Mon's seat vibrates with the turbulence of hyperspace. Mon only half listens. She knows all this. There are details that escaped her mind. She lacks the encyclopedic knowledge of rebel assets that some of her peers in high command possess. But no one is more aware than her of the Alliance's capabilities and limits. The princess should be arriving on Yavin 4 any moment.